If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of In Liberty and Health. And today we're going to be talking about the anti-imperialist coalitions, amongst many other things. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I've had one of her cohorts from the Revolutionary Blackout Network on a couple months ago, and it was a really, really cool conversation. I've enjoyed interacting with her and her other cohorts over there a lot, quite a bit. We definitely don't agree on a few things, but I've found over the time that I've been doing this podcast that it just so happens to be more of the left-wing people that are solid on all things anti-war, which is kind of frustrating coming from a more right-wing background. But we'll get into that, I'm sure. So make sure you hit all the links below where you can find my guest, what she's got going on, all that good stuff. And tigerfitness.com through the link below for all my supplements. And Fox & Sons Coffee, use code Kyle at checkout to let Steven know that I sent you to get some wonderful coffee. And without further ado, let's get into it. All right, everybody. Today I am here with Miss Sabrina Salvati, or Sabby Sabs. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, of course. So why don't we start off with your background, who you are, and kind of where, what got you to where you are today?
So I'm the host of Sabby Sabs podcast. I'm also a co-host on Revolutionary Blackout Network. How did I end up here? I was one of the people that were a part of the Bernie Sanders campaign movements, heavily supported those policies, still support those policies, and became very disappointed with the so-called progressives in Congress, along with Bernie Sanders, for abandoning their movement and telling us to support the Democrat establishment politicians that they told us that we should fight against. So I'm one of those people. I come from that camp. And I think it was after Force the Vote, or what was not Force the Vote, from the squad members, that I decided to start Sabby Sabs podcast. And in the beginning, I actually created videos for Facebook. And it was one of my friends that told me that I should probably put that on YouTube instead of Facebook, because she said Facebook is not the place for this. And so that's pretty much like how this all started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. And what I find even more interesting is that there's like this overlap of like the Bernie Sanders supporters, libertarians, and then maybe even some people who support Trump. Although obviously we can kind of delineate quite a bit between all those groups. But like there was the kind of, you know, middle finger to the establishment with all these groups. But, you know, I what I like about you, and particularly some of your cohorts that I mentioned earlier, like I had Nick on a couple months ago, and I've watched a couple other you guys shows, is that you guys were able to say like, no, the Democrats have turned their backs on us. And that's kind of how I feel, you know, Trump and a lot of like the more right wing establishment did to like a lot of the anti-war libertarians, some of the guys in like the Ron Paul camp, which I would consider myself firmly in, is that Trump basically turned around as soon as he got in and said, all right, well, I'm running to the establishment now. It's no longer about my base. I got elected. So how do I play the political game? I like that about you, and that you guys aren't afraid to speak the truth as you see it, because I think that is the most important thing that we should be doing in this alt media sphere.
I agree. That's actually why I was surprised to see Donald Trump at the Libertarian National Convention. I was really shocked to see him there. And it brings up this question, what is happening to third parties or third party movement? Why is there now this need to allow some of these voices from the two-party system to partake in third party conventions or movements? I don't think that's a good idea. I think these parties need to remain separately from the two-party system. But I was very surprised to see that.
Yeah. Well, okay. So maybe we could drill in on that a little bit. What is your opinion on kind of like libertarians and then like the third party movement of libertarianism? Because there's like the liberty movement, where I think a lot of people would probably think of like Dave Smith, who is a friend of mine. And then like the Libertarian Party is a little bit separate, but there's been an attempt at a merger. So what has been kind of like your perspective on that? And we can kind of drill in on maybe our thoughts on how Trump might have played in this whole situation.
Absolutely. I think there are some areas where I do agree with libertarians. I definitely agree with them with being anti-war, anti-imperialist. I found a common ground with them when it comes to policing as well. So there are some areas, the drug war, where I do agree with libertarians. I've interviewed a couple of libertarian guests on my show. Larry Sharp has been on my show. He's actually going to be on the show tomorrow night as well.
He's fantastic. So. I love Larry.
Yeah, interesting timing. And I know I've had discussions with him before about public banks and worker co-ops and also ballot initiatives. So there are different areas where we do find common ground. And I think that I look back to the Rage Against the War Machine rally when I remember there was a lot of criticism around that rally. I still attended the rally anyway.
I did as well.
And covered it. But I just think back to how large that event could have been if we could have, you know, bypassed the smears and just gotten a lot of people together for an anti-war coalition. I look at the numbers right now that you see all the people that are protesting against Israel in support of the Palestinian struggle. Thousands and hundreds of thousands of people out in the street, a global movement. And I just think of what that could have been or still could be with an anti-war movement today.
Right. Well, before we move on to the Gaza protests, because I do want to talk to you specifically about this, but when it comes to Donald Trump at the convention, I think Angela's perspective, who I am a good friend of, she's a good friend of mine. Her idea was to sort of get leverage with the Donald Trump administration. Now, my perspective is you don't believe a word Trump says, because we have 4 years of his record to go off of to see that he doesn't, you know, he will capitulate to the swamp before he ever thinks about capitulating to his base. So he did say he's going to put a libertarian in the cabinet and he's going to free Ross Ulbricht. Once again, I believe those are absolutely empty promises. But do you think there is a place to kind of welcome someone like a Donald Trump or maybe even like a Joe Biden or possibly even an RFK into the fold if we can kind of get some leverage on them and maybe get some more libertarian or, you know, goals that are more conductive to what our principles would be?
Not in a third party movement. Sure. I wouldn't tell Jill Stein that she should welcome Joe Biden to be a part of her coalition, right? So he's still a part of that Democrat machine. Donald Trump is still a part of that Republican Party machine. So I think that's where the defining line is for me. I think that if Donald Trump truly wants to criticize the establishment and really wants to take on corruption, why is he still a part of the two-party system, right? I would argue that if Donald Trump were to leave the Republican Party and said, that's it, I'm running with the Libertarian Party, I think he would still be just as popular because he already has an established base. But I think it gets to a point for those of us that do support third parties where we start to ask this question, what exactly do we want? What are our goals? What are we trying to achieve? I know I learned from the progressive movement that the answer was not to try to do it through the Democratic Party or to try to move Joe Biden left, as people refer to that as. Yeah. Obviously, that did not work because he's still a part of that machine. And the question that I had watching that convention, I know Donald Trump said that he would, you know, pardon Ross. I did not hear anything about Julian Assange, and Julian Assange's brother was right there in the audience. So I have to ask those questions. Like, what about Julian Assange?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a totally fair question. And it's kind of funny because conveniently, a lot of people do forget that it was under Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo that they plotted to assassinate Julian Assange. And I'm pretty sure he did say at one point that he would consider pardoning him or something like that. That might be secondhand knowledge that I heard that from. But Trump has this amazing ability I've heard Abby Martin call him Teflon Don, and that sounds about right because nothing ever seems to be able to stick with him, and nobody ever seems to recall all the things that he was bad on. Like, people still look at him as like an anti-establishment candidate. It's like, this dude was president for 4 years, hired John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, you know, attempted a coup in Venezuela, killed more people via drone strikes than any other president in history, but we're still supposed to believe that he's the most anti-war and anti-establishment candidate ever. It boggles my mind, and people just don't seem to grapple with that.
Well, Anya Parampil, she actually just published a book about the coup in Venezuela. And so I would like to see her appear on more shows so she can talk about that. I think she was just recently on George Galloway's show because I have heard this from people where they're calling Trump anti-war and they're forgetting about these things that happened under Trump's administration. Now, we'll see. He did not create any new wars. I do agree with that. But he still participated in coups, and there was also drone strikes, and people forget that he also gave money to Ukraine, not as much as under Joe Biden, but he's also, you know, participated in those things as well. When we get to the Israel issue, remember, he was the one that moved the Capitol. So that was a defining moment when we look at the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians in the Middle East as well.
So I've asked a few people this, and I'd love your opinion on it as well. It always drives me nuts when people say this war in Ukraine would have never happened under Trump. But much to your point, he sent money to Ukraine, and then he sent the Javelin anti-tank missiles into Ukraine. I apologize if you hear my dog bark, and he's but he sent the Javelin anti-tank missiles into Ukraine, which Obama said he would not do because he knew it would anger Russia.
Right. But it's funny how people forget. I think that people have had enough years under Joe Biden that now they're looking at things and they're like, you know what? Maybe it was better under Donald Trump. I can tell you economically, it definitely was better for me. Under Donald Trump, we didn't have this high inflation. The grocery store prices are astronomically high. I don't know where you live, but where I live, they're really high. Especially if you're trying to purchase some type of, like, if you're trying to buy meat, it's through the roof. It's ridiculous. So there are those concerns. And I think the number one issue on most voters' minds is the economy. So I think that people are kind of looking back to, you know, how was my wallet? How was my bank account under Donald Trump versus under Joe Biden? And I think that's why some people are, if you're solely focused on the economy, it may be easy for you to forget some of those things that happened when we talk about war under Trump's administration.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. And I would definitely agree that my life was definitely a little bit better under Donald Trump as well. But I think people kind of mix up correlation and causation there where, you know, if you look at like the fallout from the 2008 housing crash, well, then obviously over time, as we got more and more into the recovery, then, you know, things economically are going to look better and better. But then a lot of people forget that Trump's last year was 2020, which was, you know, a disaster for a lot of people. And then Trump's slogan was, let's keep America great, as you're locked in your home and your business is shut down and you're called non-essential. And then, you know, you get two measly checks and they send millions of dollars overseas and we can't get any help back here at home. And I mean, I'm a libertarian, I'm not for taxation at all, but like, you know, if you're going to lock everybody down and you're going to tell people they're not essential, shut down their businesses and stuff like that, but you're okay with sending millions overseas, like that doesn't work. Like, we can take care of people at home. We can forget about those other countries over there, you know, while everyone's locked down here.
That's right. And another thing that I will say is, you know, I watched a lot of small businesses close during the pandemic in Boston, even businesses that were considered to be tourist attractions that have been around for years, just closed because they couldn't handle a not making any revenue during that time and being able to pay for the rent of the property because they have to pay the property taxes and all of that to the city. So I watched a number of those things happen. And this happened under a Republican governor. A lot of people may not have been aware, but the governor of Massachusetts at that time, Governor Baker, is a Republican. So when I hear people say this only happened under Democrat lawmakers, that's not exactly actually true.
No.
So I just look at the loss of economic growth that we had during that time. Mm-hmm. I just think about the school system and how students were sent home to work remotely. schools just assuming that every child has a laptop at home. We're talking about kids that live in low-income neighborhoods where they actually share a bedroom with their brother or their sister and they don't have their own room, and both of them trying to learn remotely at the same time with two different teachers. It was just a mess. And I saw students' grades suffer during that time as well. So it was a terrible time. And people also forget this too. It was Trump was the one that said, let's leave it up to the states and let the governors decide. So there were some states where my parents lived in South Carolina. It was like almost like nothing happened if you went there during this time. Meanwhile, me in Massachusetts, we were very much locked down. So it was an unfortunate time for a lot of people.
Yeah. So I'm in southwestern Pennsylvania, and it was the most insane thing to me. So I'm a mechanic by trade. And then my wife at the time was working for a company that was like making ventilators and stuff like that. And the weirdest thing in the world was for her to come home and say, I have a note from my work that says it's okay for me to be out and about, like driving to work. And I got laid off. Like, cars always break. I'm sure you're aware. So I'm like, oh, no, I'll be fine. I'll never get laid off. And well, surely enough, I did. And it was only for 3 weeks. But still, I mean, it was a very, very bizarre time. And, Trump has managed to skate by without getting criticized for a lot of his handling of 2020. And people think that he's, like I said, some outside anti-establishment guy. But I mean, he really championed a lot of the stuff. Between all the spending and then, the vaccine and all that. But, people think that he's going to, potentially be better. But then, he's saying he's going to fill his cabinet with Nikki Haley, Mike Pompeo, just these total awful choices. And then his vice presidential picks are mostly just these diehard Zionists. And worst of all, Marco Rubio. Like, geez, he's learned nothing.
No, and it's weird to me that those that were against the COVID vaccine totally forget that Trump also supports that.
Yes.
So that's weird to me too.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I guess we're moving over to the Israel Gaza situation. This kind of ties in nicely with the whole anti-war right situation, because I remember everybody saying, oh my God, look how anti-war right or how anti-war the right is today, when they would refer to somebody like Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Taylor Greene. And sometimes people would even say Marco Rubio, which is insane. But then as soon as October 7th happened, I mean, all that credibility just went right out the window, because they could not wait to send more money over to Israel after, for the last 2 years, they were rightfully calling for the end to Ukraine aid, but they couldn't wait to send money over to Israel. And now, to me, I can't take any of these people seriously, because once again, they were happy to call out the Ukraine aid, and they're correct, but then they want to send all this aid to Israel. And then they'll occasionally say, oh, well, we're sending money to Gaza. It's like, you realize that's like a drop in the bucket compared to the money that we send to Israel.
The defense that they often give, and I think Vivek Ramaswamy has given this as well, is that Israel is important because of U.S. interests. But no, it's totally hypocritical. Either you're anti-war or you're not anti-war. It shouldn't matter what the country is. That's still foreign aid that the U.S. government is giving foreign aid, right? So the U.S. government gives $3.8 billion a year to Israel. Why isn't that money being invested here? In Israel, everyone has health care. Everyone doesn't have health care in the United States. In Israel, college is free. College isn't free in the United States. So there has been an awful lot of money that has been sent to the state of Israel to make sure that people there are safe and made whole. But that has not happened here in the United States for the American people. And to me, that is a problem. You should always take care of home base. And we continue to see Americans neglected. I can't walk by one subway station without seeing homeless veterans either sleeping in the subway or sleeping outside of the subway. This is a problem all around. So we're not taking care of our people. But when it comes to the state of Israel, our politicians are willing to push through legislation urgently and rapidly. But when we ask for certain demands, such as health care, we're told now is not the time. So it's a problem.
Yeah, and it's always funny, because a lot of these people who are so diehard and fervent in their support of Israel claim to be America first, but it really seems like the order that it goes is Israel first, Ukraine second, Taiwan third, maybe Taiwan second, but and then it's America. And the one thing that gets left out a lot is Taiwan in this whole situation. This is something that I just can't stop waving my hands about, because that is the federal government's number one target. They, it's not Russia. It's not Iran. It is China. And they lay that out every 4 years in the national defense strategies that, hey, we're not looking to pick a fight with Russia so much as we're looking to, you know, take on China, and we're looking to win that war with China. And there's been this, you know, totally messed up perception that Biden is somehow bought and paid for by China. And I kind of get it because there were some shady dealings, but though he's been the most hawkish, you know, person on China yet.
This is true. I think a lot of this is just optics, right? Like, so he is going to go hard at China. I think most politicians in DC do, because China economically is a competitor to the United States. I would argue so is Russia, right? But how did that happen? We have to think about all the jobs that were sent abroad, all the jobs that were sent to countries like China and also Mexico, which is often left out of that discussion when people mention NAFTA. So we removed manufacturing, a good portion of manufacturing, from the United States, and we sent those jobs abroad because of greed, because it's cheaper to have those parts made in another country than it is in the United States. Now, our politicians want to bully China because they have become economically powerful. But we sent them the jobs. So the United States government, they want to police the entire world. They want to dominate the entire world. Right. Imagine if Russia had over 800 military bases surrounding North America.
Right.
We would have a problem with that. But it's okay for us to do that to other countries.
Yeah, I mean, you're kind of seeing this play out right now, because there was that, what was it, like an aircraft carrier or something like that was off the coast of Florida or something like that, and everybody lost their minds. Or take, for example, the red balloon that flew over the country last year. Everybody, people still tell me, oh, look, China's a threat. They flew a balloon over our country. I'm like, you realize, like, you guys say that, like, these things are being spied on by, we're being spied on by TikTok, even though they've been very compliant with the U.S., but we're supposed to believe that, like, a balloon is going to come and kill us all. Like, are you guys really that dumb?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Demonizing China and Russia isn't going to make America stronger.
No.
And I wish more people understood that. We should focus more on our country. We should focus more on building up manufacturing again in this country, having more things made in the United States. That's what we should be focusing on. But no, they're focused on the competitors. They're focused on China. They're focused on Russia. And it's a problem. If you want to talk about the homeless population, there is something that you go to China, they don't really have a homeless population. They've almost eradicated homelessness. Why do we have so many homeless people here? Why haven't we done that? So these are things that to think about. Our government has a lot of money that they use to spend towards defense. Our defense budget is over $860 billion. You can reduce the defense budget and you can spend that money into building up programs or building up communities in this country or building up our infrastructure, which is incredibly falling apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Funny enough, when you come into the town that I live in, it says America's first worker-owned town. And, you know, obviously being from near Pittsburgh, there's steel mills everywhere. And it's kind of sad to see because as a musician as well, I get to drive past tons of different places and see tons of different towns. And it's kind of heartbreaking to think that, like, oh, this used to be filled with people who would feed their families from, you know, working an honest job, you know, getting calluses on their hands. You know, the average Joe, the average American dream was fulfilled by these factories. And then essentially, you know, the American government put their boot on the neck of the average person. And then these companies, you know, said, all right, well, screw it. We're going to go overseas. And instead of incentivizing companies and people to stay here in America, they once again chased them all off.
This is incredibly true. And similar here in Massachusetts, there are mill towns here, old mill towns in Massachusetts. Most people that visit the state would not know that because they don't venture out to those areas. Most people come to visit the Boston area. Sure. But if you visit the middle portion of Massachusetts and Western Massachusetts, there are quite a few of the old mill towns that are just...
Lowe's knows when you're looking for reliability, the right brand makes all the difference. And now, Lowe's is the exclusive home improvement retailer for the Whirlpool water treatment line, including their Wi-Fi softener, under-sink filtration system, and more. With Whirlpool's proven performance and our everyday low prices, better tasting, better quality water is within reach. Shop pro-trusted brands like Whirlpool and more, in-store or online. Lowe's. We help. You save.
Neglected and left behind. And it's really sad. You wouldn't think this is the United States, but it is and it does exist. And those communities were just abandoned. Nobody has tried to rebuild them as far as from what I can see, regardless of what politicians have been put into power. But you can just see the memories of how once upon a time these towns actually did thrive and people had jobs at those factories. And now you see these towns are just abandoned and somewhat deserted in some parts, and people live in poverty in those areas.
Yeah, it's kind of sad because the area that I come from, I mean, I'll be the fourth generation automotive mechanic in my family. And my grandfather and my great uncle used to own gas stations, but now you never see that anymore. I mean, it's mostly like big gas stations that are around here. I'm sure you're probably aware of, you know, way back in the day, you used to drive up over a rope or something like that. A bell would ring. Someone would come out, check your oil, check your tire pressures, fill up your car with gas. And now there's like one gas station near me that does that. And I think it's been the same guy that's owned it for, you know, probably 40, 50 years or something like that. But I mean, just stuff like that doesn't happen anymore.
No, it doesn't. Corporations have kind of come in and they've found a way to take over that industry. But it's true. I said the same thing as well about the drive-in theaters. There's a drive-in theater that we go to here in Massachusetts. It's not near the Boston area. So it's kind of a ways out that you have to go to. And it used to be a little bit more laid back, like you bring your own food and it was pretty cheap. You could see a double feature. That now also too has been corporatized. So it has been bought out and it's more expensive to do that now. But what happened to all those drive-in theaters that once existed in the United States? Why have they all been abandoned? I mean, what happened to a lot of the small mom and pop businesses? And it's just, this is something I have been warning people about, is this influx of developers that are entering the cities and also some of the rural towns as well. And they are buying up these buildings, whether it's apartment buildings, whether it's commercial property, and they are turning it into more corporatized businesses, or they're turning it into luxury condos. And sometimes the mom and pop store, they don't really have a choice to stay because investors have come in and they bought up the property right next door to them. So that increased the rent for their store. So now they can't afford to stay there either. So they have no choice but to just sell it out to another developer.
Yeah, it's really sad. So one thing that I was kind of reminded of while you were talking there was my father owns his own automotive business, and he showed me the credit card statements where just like, hey, for this transaction, it costs you 30, 40 bucks, this next one, 50, this next one, 13. I mean, it is insane the amount of money that credit card companies and everyone kind of charges them. And then he told me at one point that he called the credit card companies, asked about some of these charges, like, oh, we'll waive all these. Just make sure you charge a shop fee or something like that, so that way you cover some of these things. But okay, so now you extrapolate that. My dad's a little, you know, him and one employee, you know, work on cars there in this small town here in Pennsylvania. But then, you know, the big dealerships and then the corporations, you know, like, you know, what is it? NTB or whoever, Pennzoil, they can afford those. But though, you know, someone like my dad, he still makes money. But at the same time, you know, you just keep getting pounded with these charges and, you know, interest rates are artificially low. So that way you can't really save any money. It crushes people like that. And I'm looking at that situation. I'm like, well, hell for me, I'm probably not going to be able to take over that business if I would want to, you know, that's going to be gone. And I mean, I've had, there have been people that have been with my family for three generations that would come up to me and say, I saw your grandfather, I saw your dad grow up, and now I'm seeing you grow up. And, you know, unfortunately, the doors are probably going to have to shut because, you know, it's just not realistic for, like you said, mom and pop businesses anymore.
It's a reality, too. And this is why some small businesses in Massachusetts are cash only. It can be annoying if you come here as a tourist, because especially if you're coming from a place where they don't usually have that. It can be annoying if you go to even some of the tourist spots, like Mike's Pastries for the longest time was cash only and it is in a tourist area. And it can annoy some people, but I understand why they have it, is because they don't want to have to pay all the fees to the credit card companies just to allow people to be able to use their credit card. But it is a reality for people that own those small businesses.
Yeah, it's really sad. So one thing I wanted to hit on as well, to go back to the Israel-Gaza situation. For years, we heard that the anti-war left is gone, and now we see people out in the streets protesting against what Israel's doing. What were your kind of thoughts when this all kind of came about?
I was not surprised. I actually started talking about this almost 3 years ago now when I learned about what was happening to the Palestinian people. We actually had a panel interview with the Palestinian Network over at Revolutionary Blackout Network almost 2 years ago, where they explained a lot of things to us. They were actually the ones that made me realize that a two-state solution could not work, and here is why. So okay. I used to believe that too. I used to believe two-state solution is the right way to go. So I've done a lot of research about this issue, and also I've interviewed people like, you know, Max Blumenthal from The Gray Zone. I've watched the documentary from Abby Martin. I've read a lot of things. So I had to educate myself. And once I started to educate myself, that's when I realized that it's only a matter of time before those people, the Palestinian people that are occupied, are going to want to resist in some type of way, are going to try to break free of the gates that surround them in Gaza. And then there's the issue with the West Bank. I remember years ago watching Israeli settlers drag Palestinian people out of their homes and just taking over their homes. And I just thought to myself, like, what if that was happening here to us? Like, how would you feel if someone came to your house and dragged you out of your home and said, this is now my house, you can't live here, simply because you're Palestinian and this land now belongs to us? So it was very clear to me 3 years ago that the goal was to ethnically cleanse the land.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I want you to elaborate on that a little bit more, because you said you've, because I love learning more about this, but like, it's very odd to me that the right wing America First loves Israel so much when Netanyahu basically, to quote Tucker Carlson, he kind of looks at our country as like a dumping ground, because what he basically says is that, like, oh, we want to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians because we don't like that group, but we're okay with ethnically cleansing them so long as everybody else has to take them in. And not that I have a problem with necessarily Palestinian people, but it's the perspective of, we don't think these people are worth our time or allowed to stay in their homes, so therefore we're going to ethnically cleanse them, and we think that your country is lesser than ours, so we're going to send them over there. It's just a very disrespectful attitude, but they can't wait to send their money to Israel. It's so bizarre to me that, like, the Israeli government essentially looks at our government as like a dumping ground and is kind of like, you know, a cash cow. They have no respect for us.
Well, the big problem comes back to the money. The Israeli lobby owns Congress, right? So this is something that JFK actually tried to stop before he was killed. Imagine that. JFK apparently was not fond of the fact that Israel was developing weapons and spoke out against that. He was supposed to actually tour the facility that they were building in Israel before he was killed. So there have been documents that have been released by journalist Rick Sterling through Mint Press News, where he's actually posted the physical documents of the communication between JFK and Israel's government at that point in time, that he did not approve of what they were trying to do. And his biggest concern is that they would push the Palestinian people out, which is exactly what we see, what ended up happening. So there's that piece to it as well. The one person that was vocal about that and wanted to prevent it also wanted to prevent AIPAC from being able to have the power that it has. During that time, it went under a different name, but JFK saw AIPAC as a foreign agent and wanted it to register as a foreign agent. This is an organization that is doing the bidding for Israel, not for the United States. Right. Why is it that a foreign entity is allowed to lobby in Congress, lobby our politicians? So AIPAC and there's another one, J Street, they have tremendous control and a hold over the politicians in DC. And that is why they rush to defend Israel at all costs.
Yeah. So what would be your thoughts about somebody like a Thomas Massie?
This is so interesting. I mentioned this last night. I was talking about the interview that he had with Tucker Carlson, which I thought was really interesting. I watched that full interview, by the way. There's another portion of the interview where he shows his family home, and it looks like they have like a massive farm or whatever. And he was talking about the way that he grew up. Thomas Massie, he's interesting. I like the fact that he is against sending money, you know, abroad for these foreign wars. So I like that he speaks out about that. He spoke out against the war in Ukraine. He's also speaking out against the war with Israel and Gaza. I agree with him with that perspective. But I do think it's important for people to understand that his rejection of the conflict is not because he disagrees with what Israel is doing or because he supports the Palestinian cause. He just disagrees with money being sent abroad for foreign endeavors. So I would actually like to talk to Thomas Massie. I would like to interview him about that and see if I can find a way to get him to make the connection between the wars that we have also participated in, whether they've been proxy wars or they've been led by the U.S. government, how that has actually impacted the immigration issue in the United States. So I want him to make that connection.
Yeah, well, you know, I always try to make that connection with people as well, that our foreign policy definitely influences the fact that we have so many immigrants coming here is because we're basically destroying these people's homes. And then they look at our country and realize, well, it's like, you know, you guys' country isn't getting destroyed, so we're just going to go there. Now, the only thing I would say, I'm pretty sure Thomas Massie did say in that interview that he was concerned at the fact that Israel had killed 1% of the population in Gaza. Now, I'm guessing that that would mean that he doesn't like that, but I would definitely agree with your point that he's a little bit soft-handed in his criticisms. So do you have anything to add to that? Because I got one more question.
Well, I know Tucker Carlson did ask him. He said, why did you vote against this bill for Israel? Is it because you don't support Israel? And Thomas Massie said, well, no, it's not that I don't support Israel. Okay. I'm not going to criticize Israel. So that was the part there that was, you know, really interesting to me. It also was apparent to me that he had to make it abundantly clear that he's not trying to target Israel, right? He's not trying to attack them as well. And it just, again, it just goes to show you how powerful the Israeli lobby has become.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I think that's understandable. And yeah, I did notice that as well. One thing that I've found very, very frustrating when talking to the pro-Israeli side is that they'll say, when you bring up the death count in Gaza, they'll say, oh, well, those are Hamas numbers. But then they'll ignore the fact that the IDF uses those numbers and says, hey, those are true. And then not only that, over the last, you know, what is it, decade, those numbers have actually been consistently shown to be an undercount. What are your thoughts on that? And how do you engage with that argument?
Right. So this is a part of the Zionist propaganda. There's a number of talking points that they use to make you think that anything that comes from Hamas, you should discredit because it's Hamas. Right. So that's how they deny the numbers. Another talking point that they use is that Israel has a right to defend itself, but apparently Gaza does not. So people have to remember Gaza does not have a military. Right. So Hamas, we refer to them over at RBN as resist. They were a form of resistance that was built. Right. And it was funded by Netanyahu. But you'll never hear like Zionist argument tell you that information, that Netanyahu funded them as a sort of opposition. So there's that. So they have a number of talking points that they use. Israel has a right to exist, but apparently Gaza doesn't. Apparently the West Bank doesn't, at least for the Palestinian people. They don't want to really go into the history, but when they're forced to go into the history, they say, well, they denied the right to have their own state, which actually isn't 100% true. What they failed to mention to people, and this is on purpose, is that there have also been a number of times where Israel rejected a Palestinian state. Netanyahu is on record saying this for decades, that he did not want the Palestinian people to have their own state. There was also the Arabic agreement in 2002, I believe, where Israel was the one that the Arab Peace Initiative, Israel was the one that actually rejected the agreement, not Hamas. So there are a number of things that they leave out, and that is intentional. They try to tell you that this is not about ethnic cleansing. This is about keeping Israel safe. But a lot of people are not mentioning the fact that this was reported by multiple outlets that Israel actually sterilized Ethiopian Jews. So these were people who were Jewish, Ethiopian Jewish women, against their will to stop them from reproducing in Israel. So there are a number of things that you can point to that they purposely leave out. But again, the idea is to demonize the Palestinian people at all costs. And I think that a lot of Americans have been, particularly after September 11, were convinced that you should be afraid of Islam. You should be afraid of Muslim people. And obviously that is not true, right? They're extremists in every religion. But a lot of people fell for that after 9/11. And people also leave out that Palestinians have different religions. There are Palestinians that are Muslim, that are Jewish, that are Christian. So I think it's just, it's really unfortunate the way that they have demonized that group of people.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting because you just kind of gave me another little nugget of information that I didn't know. I've thrown this theory out here and I'm curious your thoughts on it. When it comes to the stuff with Israel and the propaganda about China, it's very interesting that almost everything that you hear our government accuse China of doing, either our government or Israel is actually guilty of doing. So I'm sure you heard about the Uyghur genocide, which had absolutely no evidence. And, you know, Max Blumenthal did a wonderful debunking on that. And they claimed that there were forced sterilizations. Well, now you just brought up the forced sterilizations. You know, once again, alleged genocide while Israel is actually genociding the Palestinians. The Chinese infiltration into our tech sector, but it's actually Israeli infiltration into our tech sector. You know, China spying on us, but then, you know, there's the Mossad wiretapping the White House during, you know, I think it was phone sex with Bill Clinton or something like that. So just like the more and more stuff I hear, it's like, wow, it really seems like there's almost a concerted effort through some kind of entity, through AIPAC or our government to, you know, blame everything on China, but then it's actually our government and the Israeli government that are guilty of all the things that they're accusing China of doing.
Right. Every accusation is a confession. And it's sad what Israel has become. I personally do not believe there should be a religious state, period. I support separation of church and state we have here in this country. And, you know, this is part of the reason, because Israel was able to use that, to use the religion as an excuse to remove the Palestinian people. So we have to separate, we have to make sure we separate Judaism and Zionism. Israel is not doing that. They have, you know, blended the two together. And I think it's a dangerous thing. It's really like Zionism is very dangerous. And it's, I guess I don't want to say scary, but it is concerning that Zionism has become so powerful that there are multiple networks, whether it's in the United States or abroad, that are able to, you know, put out these smear campaigns against people, getting journalists fired, getting students, you know, doxxed. And it just the way the inner workings of it all, it's very concerning.
Yeah, I agree. And it's like you said, it's concerning because now what happens is, and I see this a lot more in my sphere, because I think some people get a little too far down what we would call the JQ rabbit hole, which I think is kind of disgusting when everybody starts saying, oh, well, this is all Jewish people that are doing this. But it's an awful smear because, like, there are plenty of, you know, Jewish people that are against what the state of Israel is doing. In fact, I think there's that a Jewish Voice for Peace, and they're a very, very big organization that's, you know, against what they're doing to the Palestinians. So I get really frustrated when you see people do stuff like that, because people like you and I that are rightfully calling for the end to what's going on in Gaza, when people see somebody with a Nick Fuentes profile picture pointing to somebody and saying they're Jewish because they don't say that it's all Jews that are guilty for this, then we look awful by association. So it just drives me nuts when people kind of mix the two together, because they should be separate, because there are, you know, just regular Jewish people that may not be religious or aren't hardcore Zionists that disagree with what's going on there. But then when you say, oh, it's all Jews that are guilty for this, then once again, it's just an ugly smear.
That is true. And a lot of the protesters are Jewish. Same thing with the encampments that were at the universities. A lot of the protesters at the campuses are also Jewish. But see, this is the thing, like, they do want you to see it as one. And that's why, because if you do see Zionism and Judaism as one thing, then it's easier for them to do activities like trying to change the definition of what it means to be anti-Semitic and putting legislation forward for that in Congress, right? So it's easier for them to do that. And now we see all these people, Candace Owens being fired because she said Christ is king, or because she questioned the state of Israel, or she wasn't pro-Israel. This is very dangerous. And it's borderline McCarthyism smears, it feels like. You know, there's like this witch hunt after people who don't support or approve of Zionism. And that is a dangerous concept.
Yeah, and you would think that under the Biden, you know, regime, if you will, that Republican governors would be doing a lot more to kind of embolden their base and get them to support them. But instead, they're literally, it's been Republicans left and right authoring all these anti-BDS laws, you know, pro-Israeli speech laws, where if you criticize the state of Israel, like Kristi Noem passed that law, if you question the Holocaust, and I'm not saying you should or shouldn't, but even if you just question it or question the way that the Israeli government operates, you get fined in South Dakota. So, you know, what happened to the First Amendment? I thought the Republicans were supposed to be the guys that were champions of free speech, you know?
And this is a good, it's a good point that you brought that up. It's something I want to mention to people. What you see happening right now with the power of the Israeli lobby, this hold that they now have captured over free speech, that is threatening. And if you care about censorship, if you care about free speech, that should be concerning to you. I have never seen any other organization be this powerful that they can literally have Congress rushing through legislation to try to change the definition of words. I've never seen them move this fast for any other group. So it is concerning. And I'm glad that Thomas Massey voted against that. I was like, no, we're not doing this, because it just... where does this lead us?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's disturbing because it's already on the books in 38 states. And I didn't know this until a few months ago. I know Abby Martin fought that lawsuit down in Georgia. But I mean, it's, I don't want to say 1984, but I mean, like, very disturbing to think that, like, if you just question a foreign government, like, imagine if China had those laws here, people would rightfully lose their minds. But because it's Israel, can't touch it.
That's right. It's very true. And another thing I want to mention to people is that Palestinians are Semites. If you look at the definition of what it means to be a Semite, that includes people who speak Arabic language. That includes the Palestinian people. So they are also Semites. And it's just, it's, we have to continue to say that to people, because a lot of people are being accused of being, you know, anti-Semitic now because they are anti-Zionist. So when people throw that at you, I think it's important that, yes, anti-Semitism does exist, but it's gotten to the point now where people are using that word against people who are just for criticizing Israel's government. So it now has this broad brush of a definition of what that means. So when that gets thrown at you and you know that what you were doing is not anti-Semitic, I think it's important to, again, push back and say Palestinians are Semites.
Right. I agree. So I know you're a little bit of a time crunch. I appreciate you coming on today. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. Let everybody know where they can find you, support you, and all that good stuff.
Absolutely. You can find me here on YouTube, the Savvy Sabs podcast. And you can also find me at Revolutionary Blackout Network on YouTube as well.
All right. Awesome, Savvy Sabs. Well, I really appreciate your time, and hopefully we'll have another conversation sometime in the future. I want to give a shout out to Misty Winston as well for helping us get this all set up. So if you don't got anything else, we'll wrap there.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening. Until next time, take care.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow and Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.